Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 316. Janet, can you give us a rundown, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 316 was at the request of Senator, sponsored by Senator Dukes and Senator Gordley, and it would require that state agencies notify the Office of the Advocate for Minority Women and Emerging Small Business when an award of a public contract is made with a value of $5,000 or more. State law already requires agencies to notify the office for bid requests for and bid solicitations, but not once the award is made. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There, it's my understanding there's no fiscal impact on the bill, and
it says no fiscal.
No fiscal impact, and the Senate vote was 24 to 2.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Gordley, please. Thank you, Senator, for your patience with us this morning getting started.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and no problem. For the record, I am Avell Gordley, representing Senate District 23, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in northeast and southeast Portland. And, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to invite forward a couple of people who are going to assist in providing information on this measure. The governor's office staff, first Lydia Muniz from the Office of, who is the advocate for minority women and emerging small business. And then we also have someone here from the Department of Administrative Services, if she would join me as well. And I apologize for blanking on the name.
This must be Diane.
Thank you, and forgive me. Again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 316 this afternoon, and I'm just going to request respectfully right up front that you go into work session on this bill and pass it out today, and I believe that we'll make a compelling case for why we would like you to do that. Let me put the discussion of Senate Bill 316 in some statutory context by providing, if you will, a framework to point out why this enhancement to existing statute is necessary. I would first draw your attention to, again, and this is existing statute captured in ORS 243.305, which is the policy on affirmative action. And again, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'm going to read the policy statement into the record. This is the policy of affirmative action and fair and equal employment opportunities and advancement, which states that it is declared to be the public policy of Oregon that all branches of state government shall be leaders among employing entities within the state in providing to its citizens and employees through a program of affirmative action fair and equal opportunities for employment and advancement in programs and services and in the awarding of contracts. And I'm putting the emphasis on the awarding of contracts, again, in the context of the measure before you. The statute, again, 243305, goes on to conclude that affirmative action means a method of eliminating the effects of past and present discrimination, intended or unintended, on the basis of race, religion, national origin, age, sex, marital status, or physical or mental disabilities. And again, that's existing law. And another relevant statute for your consideration is captured in ORS 659A.015, which is the statute relating to affirmative action reports needing to include information on contracts to minority businesses. And that policy says that in carrying out the policy of affirmative action, the aforementioned policy on affirmative action, every state agency shall include in its affirmative action reports under ORS 659A.012 information concerning its awards of construction, service, and personal service contracts awarded to minority businesses. And then finally, Mr. Chair and members, there is the statute captured in your staff measure summary, which is ORS 200.035, which says that all state agencies shall provide timely notice of all contracts and bid requests, solicitations in excess of $5,000 to the advocate for minority women and emerging small business. Now, what is missing from the statute that I just read is a requirement that there be a reporting of the results of the notice of solicitations. And it is at this point that I'm going to stop, and I'm going to look to my left and right at the what we call certified smart people who can carry the discussion forward to enhance your understanding of why we see the need for an enhancement to existing law.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Gordley. For the record, my name is Lydia Muñiz. I am the governor's advocate for minority, women, and emerging small businesses. And this morning I am here to express my support for this bill. And a little bit of background, the statutory authority for my office and my position exists under ORS 200.025 and ORS 200.035, and 035 is the subject of Senate Bill 316, which we're discussing this morning. As you've heard, current statute, ORS 200.035, currently requires all state agencies to notify the advocate's office of any contract bid solicitation in excess of $5,000. What current statute does not do right now is to require the reporting of the contract award. And so we currently have no statewide comprehensive tracking mechanism to be able to provide that data when it is requested so that we know how the state is doing specifically with awards of their contracting. The issue addressed in this particular bill addresses that, the contract award piece, which would add some language to existing statute that would require state agencies to, in addition to notifying their solicitations, at the end of an award, they would also submit information about who they've awarded that contract to. And again, I would emphasize that that is much needed data that both the legislature, state agencies, and I think the public has been very interested in having that information. And by adding that to the current statute, we would be well on our way to begin to track that information and provide you that information.
Thank you, Lydia. Go ahead, Diane, with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Brown, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, and I'm the state's chief procurement officer for the Department of Administrative Services. You have a brief bit of written testimony in front of you. The department supports Senate Bill 316. We have been working with Lydia and interim groups, stakeholder groups, the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs, and others to come to agreement on this reporting requirement, and DAS will support state agencies in accommodating their reporting to the Governor's Advocate's Office through the use of the Oregon Procurement Information Network. So we have an electronic means to make this straightforward and easy for agencies to do. So with that, I'll rest.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holby.
I just have one. I see that this is just for state agency contracts. This doesn't affect counties, cities, and other public contracting agencies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, this is only directed at state agencies. That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, Janet's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for any of the three of you. Is the purpose so kind of a tracking to see where awards went, or so that some of the minority women and emerging small business will know for subcontracting purposes?
Mr. Chair and Janet, the purpose of current statute, ORS 200.035, is kind of twofold. One is the information is provided to us on a solicitation that a state agency might have. What my office does then, in turn, is we notify, we work with about 1,600 certified firms that are owned by minorities and women and other small businesses. And so when there is a match, we notify the businesses of that there is a potential opportunity with the state. And so what the award would capture is, are we doing a good job of utilizing those firms that are already certified with the state of Oregon, number one. Secondly, it gives us, I think, a real picture of the state's spend in its contracting.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Your patience.
Appreciate you hearing the bill. Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 316A? And then we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 316A and open a work session on Senate Bill 316A. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 316A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves 316A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holgate.
Aye.
Representative Pitts.
Excuse.
Representative Shockley. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Shields, would you like to carry the bill on the floor for us?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I've been asked by my esteemed former colleague from the Senate to take the bill to the floor on her behalf, and I'd be honored.
Representative Esquivel will carry the bill on the floor then. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2535. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Smith.
Right. Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Smith's amendments are what we'll be discussing, and we'll pass those out. I don't believe they, I believe they're getting stuff right, so you don't need to pay attention to the original bill. And
only the relating clause, and that everything else beyond that is doesn't mean much now.
That's correct. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes the beautiful counties of Union and Wallala, Umatilla, and Morrow. And I have to tell you, as I look out the window and see the sunny weather outside, I can tell you it's going to be a beautiful three-day weekend up on Wallala Lake. So I hope during the summer you folks will have a chance to come up and join us up there. Truly appreciate the opportunity to be for you this morning. I hope each of you have had an opportunity to receive and perhaps just peruse House Bill 2535's proposed amendments. This is an effort that is being brought forward to you with the assistance of the Legislative Fiscal Office after the result of critical examination of economic development in the state of Oregon. I say critical examination not to raise any eyebrows, but just to let you know that the Ways and Means process is working through trying to determine what is the proper role of economic and community development as the state of Oregon begins to come out of a recession. Let me share with you very quickly, if I may, just my professional resume, and then I'd like to advance forward with the proposed amendments. After coming out of Portland State University working on an MBA, I had the distinct pleasure of working for a small little development company called Greater Eastern Oregon Development Corporation. It's a 501c4 EDA community development corporation that had just received a contract to manage a program called Regional Strategies. And I showed up on November 1st, and by November 10th, I was handed a notebook and told, you're now the administrator of Regional Strategies, and oh, by the way, the EDA grant that was due on June 30th needs to be completed. Okay. After about a year of doing that, I was promoted to a loan officer position where I began to structure, package, and process commercial loans with SBA, EDA, and eventually the Regional Strategies Board created a small loan program. From there, we developed into USDA IRP lending. About a year later, I was invited by the Port of Morro to come over and to work with the port, helping them with their marketing and their business development. There, I served in a role of helping them structure financing, working on projects from $5,000 to $50 million, working with companies from Green and Feed on Main Street in Heppner to Portland General Electric and Tidewater and Cargill. During that time, I also had an opportunity to travel to 37 countries and five continents promoting value-added ag products, working with the Department of Economic Development at the time, and the Department of Agriculture. When I was elected to the legislature, I realized that it didn't look good for the fox to be watching the hen house, if you will, and I resigned from the Port of Morro. As I was walking out the door, not sure how I was going to feed my family the next day on a legislative salary, the Port of Morro said, would you be interested in serving as a contractor to still structure debt? Since that time, I've taken what was then a small little mom-and-pop consulting business, if you will, and I've grown it into seven employees with contracts all over the state of Oregon, doing everything from assisting small business owners to structuring debt with banks. So I feel adequately prepared now to bring forward to you the proposed amendments to House Bill 2535. Let me tell you the issue before you. We have a very, very talented staff in economic development. I want to put on the record right now that Lynn Beaton, Mike Burton, Ron Fox, Sarah Garrison are excellent. They know their business. I have to put on the record that Jill Miles and Rick Minster, our regional development officers out in rural eastern Oregon, are excellent. They know their job. They do it very well. Here's the problem. The department is perceived as Santa Claus. The department is perceived as the Wizard of Oz. The department is also a garbage can where things that just can't be done, send them to the Economic and Community Development Department, let them be the bad guys. Over the last 30 years, the department has evolved. And about every 2 years, a new Greg Smith comes forward and says there's a better way to run economic development. And you know, that discussion ensues. What I'm hoping this time, colleagues, is that we create a true process in which we can help the department take the very, very good work they're doing and help insulate them and help put them on a path that's going to allow them to do the work they need to do with realistic expectations, realistic performance measures, realistic statutory language, and then, if you will, step back and let them run their course. Now, let me tell you why this is different. Over the last 10 to 12 years, this body's been under a term-limited environment. And so every 6 years, or every third term, if you will, someone was chairing the committee that oversaw their budget. As soon as that individual left, a new person came in with a new vision. What I'm hoping is now with the maturation of this body, we're going to be able to have some historical knowledge and we're going to be able to create a framework similar to what they had in the 70s, if you will, when ports were the primary item in economic development. Then in the 80s, when Barbara Roberts moved forward her vision with the Regional Strategies Program. And I'm hoping we can create a framework that for perhaps 6 to 10 years, we can create a real vision to move forward. Let me share with you what the proposed amendments do. This is going to create a task force that is going to be made up of 2 members of the Senate, 2 members of the House, 2 members of the governor's office. We're going to have representation from the counties, the cities, the ports. And let me tell you why those are listed 1, 2, and 3. Those are the economic development deliverers at the local level. Now, you have nonprofit development corporations and you have other entities, but it's the counties, the cities, and the ports that work with those folks to get this done. We next have, we want to make sure we have a commercial lending institution represented there. Because let me tell you, it's the banks who are truly the finances behind development in the state. We want to make sure that small business, medium business, and large business in the state of Oregon is represented. And then we want to make sure arts and culture is. Because when you start getting into larger communities, their concern perhaps isn't, you know, the water line in the ground. It's how are we going to develop the amphitheater? To them, that's economic development. And then we also want to make sure that if we were missing additional members, say perhaps from the federal government, USDA, SBA, EDA, they would have an opportunity to bring them on. What we're hoping to do is to take a look at where is the state's economy today, what tools do we have, and what can we do to assist the department in taking that and moving forward a vision for the next 6 to 10 years. If you'll notice, we've made sure that this is a bipartisan approach. We've made sure that there's co-chairs, one from the Senate, one from the House, and we're hoping that will bring a joint effort, if you will, to this process. If you go to Section 3, our intent is to bring someone in who could serve as a consultant or a mediator to help garner the best ideas and bring them together, to take existing plans out there and bring them together. Let me share with you why that's important. All of you have heard, I assume, of the Oregon Business Plan. All of you? I've never had one person come and talk to me about the Oregon Business Plan. Now, as chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, you would hope someone would have come to the state and sat down with the person who's trying to move this through and said, hey, here's what we're trying to do. What do you think? You know, is there a way to make this work? Not one person. That has to change. We have to bring all those ideas together, get the best of what is out there, and try and move forward. So we want to look at... we want to look at what's going on out there. What are the best practices? We want to look at current statutory language. If you look at the statutory language for economic development, you know what we should be doing? We should be fully funding our ports, and we ought to be dedicated to small business, because that's where about 80% of the statutory language lies. And then there's stuff for infrastructure, little pieces on international, little pieces on innovation, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, we have a lot of other interests out there. The state is growing, the state is evolving, and we need to make sure that the statutory language reflects the needed changes in this current environment. We want to make sure that funding and staffing levels and other resources that affect what we're asking them to do is appropriate. It goes back to my comment earlier that the department is perceived as Santa Claus. I guarantee you, if you go to the Chamber of Commerce, any community, and you say you want to undertake a program, but how are we going to fund it? Inevitably, someone in there will say, we've got to get a hold of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. It's guaranteed. And so instantly, the department is now being put on notice that there's a community out there with a wish, and they now serve as Solomon, if you will, of determining whether or not that is going to work or not. Well, the fact is, they don't have all the money in the world, and there's an awful lot of little communities out there. There's an awful lot of big cities. There's an awful lot of counties, ports, et cetera, and we have to help insulate them from that process so that way every 2 years you don't have a Greg Smith before you saying we need to change economic development. We have to do this better. We have to make it work for the state, and we have to figure out a better long-term approach. We want to make sure that if there's barriers to delivering economic and community development, we know what they are and we address them. We want to make sure that the delivery mechanism works. We want to make sure that if there's finance tools out there, that we're getting the best bang for the buck and the greatest leverage. Next, what we want to do is we want to make sure that we get buy-in from the entire public. Once this is done and we hopefully have a plan that represents not only rural Oregon but urban Oregon, not only small business but large business, not only high tech but also natural resource, we want to be able to come back to you folks, the policymakers, and say, here's what this committee has done. Will you help us work through the current statutory language and make the necessary changes to take economic development and help them focus on what's most important for the state of Oregon and help implement those changes? Then we're hoping that the Ways and Means process will take the policy work you folks concur or don't concur with and create a budget developed around this. This is an effort that, in conclusion, that I truly appreciate the joint effort of Senator Johnson with me on this. I appreciate Co-Chair Scott and Co-Chair Schrader and their willingness to allow this type of process to occur. Again, I want you to know this is not a poke in the eye of the department. This isn't what this is about. This is about taking very talented folks and making sure they have the tools and the statutory language they need to deliver what you folks as the policymakers need to have done. And we want to be able to bring you a framework and say, this is what the committee thinks. Now you folks tweak it and get the language to work with what you want to do. So that's where we're hoping to go with this. If you folks concur with this, we hope that you'll adopt the proposed amendments to House Bill 2535, send it down to Ways and Means so we can put some money behind this to do this thing correctly. And then we're hoping after that we'll send it from the House over to the Senate, where Senator Johnson is waiting eagerly to catch this and to carry it through on that side. So, thank you, Chair Brown.
Thank you, Representative. What's the time frame?
In terms of completing this?
Yes.
We're hoping to begin soon after session ends, whenever that is, and have this completed by September of 06. So that way the governor's office will have the necessary time to adjust his budget to reflect what the committee works on. And so we're truly trying to make this work for everyone.
Any questions?
Just a comment. I'm glad to see the September 1st deadline. I think it makes sense, and I hope that doesn't move. I think that should be part of the charge whenever you add the money to it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a great step to me. I'm just kind of curious how you developed the different regions. Did that come from existing economic regions of the state, or?
I'm going to punt on this issue and let you know that the Association of Oregon Counties provided these to me. I have enough wisdom to know you never pick someone else's region, and so this came from the counties.
Okay. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Yeah, I have no problem with this either, but on the committee, the co-chairperson shall recommend legislation. Will that be a majority of the vote of the group, or will it have to be unanimous? How's that all going to work out?
You know, what we tried to do is we tried to have an odd number of 15, and so I'm assuming it would be based upon probably the recommendation we'd get from our committee administrator. I'm assuming it's going to be a majority. What I'm truly hoping, though, is that we're able to take this process and run it very similar to the way the Ways and Means process in my committee's currently running, and that we try and get consensus. I think in the House Ways and Means Subcommittee that I run, I think I've only had two dissenting votes, and both of those were for personal ethical reasons by the member. Other than that, we truly try and make this work. If economic development doesn't work for urban folks, if it doesn't work for rural, if it doesn't work for large business or small business, it's not going to work. Economic development has to be inclusive. It has to be. And so that's the objective on this.
I tell you, my experience in which is fairly limited in running task force, but one of the first to order businesses, you adopt your rules,
yep.
and you lay down those parameters then on how you handle it, deal with those issues.
Yep.
Well, this sounds like a very ambitious undertaking to me. I can well understand where your next 2 years or 18 months will be spent. Is there any other question?
It's not a question, it's another comment. Representative Smith. I think you and I have had this discussion on these regional ideas. I'm hopeful the committee will look at that. We have Oregon Department of Transportation regions. We have different regions, and they don't jive. And I would hope that would be one of the thrusts of this committee to try and work that out.
Chair Brown, Representative Gilman, excellent point. I would share with you, we've already reached out to Housing and Community Services, to the Department of Transportation, to the Employment Department. I'm trying to figure out who else I've missed. We want everyone at the table, because you're hitting it right on the head. Transportation has to play a key role in this. Housing has to play a key role. Workforce has to. ODF&W, Water Resources, has to play a key role. And what we're going to hope to do is bring those efforts together. Now, this I don't want to create an expectation. I don't want to be the music man coming in here telling you in 2 years we're going to roll out this magnificent plan that's going to change the state of Oregon's economy. This is what we're hoping is an approach that the department can incrementally take steps to move forward over a period of time. And because, again, we don't have term limits, that we'll have historical knowledge in here, and all 90 of us will be able to say, okay, now we understand why that framework was in place and why we're moving forward going in that manner. So. And just adding to that, and so that way when transportation decisions are being made, you folks will be able to say, well, how does that fit in with the economic development plan that the department has put together, and natural resource folks or housing.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Lynn Beaton, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Beaton. I'm the manager of the Central Operations Division with the Department of Economic and Community Development. We appreciate and encourage this type of a process. It's something that has been talked about with a number of legislators and our director over the last few months, which is the idea of having an interim committee that really evaluates what the department's doing and what the state's trying to do with economic development. So we support the concept. In fact, I've been with the agency for 9 years, and this would be the fourth reorganization and look that I've been part of, because we're clearly popular and we affect a lot of people across the state, and a lot of people want to have a voice and a say in how we do that. So we do appreciate the idea, and we support it. The governor's office supports this as well. With that said, I had not seen the language till today, so very quickly reading it in the back of the room, I'm struck by a few things. One, it is very extensive, it's very comprehensive, and it would be a lot of work. And the agency is definitely ready to go to work on this. We're ready to support something like this and be staff members to it and help provide information. I would offer a couple of comments on the membership of the groups. First, we really support having the counties, the cities, and the ports in particular, because we work with them so much, provide them a lot of funding, and work as partners with them. I think we would want to ensure that you also had a local economic development organization or representative, and again, that might end up being part of the membership depending on who was selected by the governor, the House, and the Senate. But I just wanted to state that for the record. We would also want to ensure that we had good representation across the state, so that we really weren't focusing on just one region of the state in particular, but we're looking at statewide. And finally, I would ask that that you include as a member of the committee either the director of the department or a member of our commission. We think that at least having one member representing the department as part of the committee might be helpful, might inform the discussion, and we would request that. But other than that, again, with a quick perusal, this does look very ambitious, as was stated, and we appreciate that, but we are quite willing to be part of the effort. And with that, I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Tom Gallagher, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
So I understand you already had a golf game this morning?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It didn't go real well. There seemed to be some difficulties out there, the tension from the legislature. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Portland Business Alliance, the Urban Developers Coalition, and Snitzer Industries, and very much in support of this bill. Greg went through a very good background that he has. Let me talk to you about what I've been doing the last two or three years. If you recall, Pat Allen and I were in front of this committee in the introductory stages talking about rule streamlining procedures and so forth. There was another committee that dealt with Senate Bill 2011 that dealt with permitting on the state level. And the frustration that we came to is out of both of those committees, very little is going to happen. I think this bill is a step in the right direction. Greg is focused here on economic development and on regional strategies and a regional vision and a state vision. Actually, 2011 asked the Economic Development Department to write a statewide business plan, which I hope all of you have read and made your judgments about how well they did that task. And I think they're going to come back and do it better in this bill. There are other pieces that should be tied into this. I don't think they have to go in this bill. I think they'll come in parallel. We're talking about economic development, and we're talking about bringing the lottery resources, and we're talking about assisting local communities and doing that economic development. It has to be done differently in Portland than it does out in the other parts of the region. But we're also going to be start talking about state permitting. The land use policies, water policies, and the other policies, if you have this economic development agency pushing forward, if they don't have the cooperation and the assistance of the other agencies, it's frustrating and doesn't move. One of the biggest things we understood is there's conflicting statutory direction out there in all of these agencies. Economic development doesn't have permitting authority and doesn't have any authority to move, push, or drag other agencies along when it tries to accomplish something. Integrating the state agency directions and bringing economic development into all the aspects of the state agencies without restricting any of the good policies we've developed on economic development and so forth is very important. We're struggling on all of our land use bills over transportation and infrastructure funding. There is never going to be enough money in this state to do all of the plans and things that we're thinking about. But we really don't have a good system for prioritizing where we spend our money and what projects we work on and how we go at the key projects that are integrated into the whole system. The places where we need these special dollars to make other things work. We don't have the interrelationships between the agencies to do that. It's really not something the governor's office can do. They don't operate as the CEO of the state. That's something we have to build into the statutory structure. I think that this task force, as it meets, will begin to come forward and do some of the things on the economic development side. We'll begin to match regionalization where we need to be on land use planning and on transportation planning. And I'm hoping, and I'm going to go to work, to make sure that all of the business groups in this state bring their brains and their input and their time into helping this consultant and helping this task force. You need the Oregon Business Council. You need the AOI. You need the Small Business Association. You need the Restaurant Association and every other one of these business groups, along with the labor groups, to come in and take a look about how we get Oregon back to work and back to moving again. The revenue that's going to come in the state is going to come from new jobs. And new jobs are going to increase our taxes. The golden myth of great tax reform out there that's going to solve everybody's problem hasn't occurred since I started lobbying this building. The first tax reform plan I saw was in the Straub administration. It's not going to happen overnight. We haven't passed a major tax measure in this state since the 1960s. So these are the directions that we need to go. We need to get these state agencies pulling in the same direction. We need an economic vision that's directed to each region, and we need the flexibility and dedication and determination to pull that off. I think this is a very important bill, and I wish there were many more business groups in this room coming in here saying the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shawford.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I mean, there's a lot of ideas out there that economically can help us. I think this Connect Oregon, I think we could bond for more than $100 million and stay financially sound. These highway projects of state significance, and I think these are things that we could agree on and not have somebody jump up and down with their hair on fire. But, you know, there's a lot of other things that I want this group to address, and I think you're just going to have to allow other, these folks to come in and discuss it with us, as, or whoever's on this. We our natural resources, we're not taking advantage of them. Hydropower, water out of the Columbia. I'm giving you a headache as I speak, I'm sure. But you know, the minute we bring these subjects up, if anything comes out of this dealing with any of that stuff, it's just going to cause a huge argument and debate about the environment and what some people think is destruction and other people think is sustainable. And I don't know how we're going to get over that. I think that's the hump in this state. I don't think it's tax reform. The hump is getting some kind of statewide agreement on where we're going with our natural resources and our land use. And that's the hump, Tom. And how we get over that, I think we can reform taxes easier than get over that hump. But that's my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, what we have lost among the interest groups is the ability to get to bigger public policy and to achieve it in an evolutionary manner and with balance. Balance for all of the different interest groups. This bill is going to be a legislative directive, and you're going to have an agency involved. Just in your experiences here, what's the vision and cooperation between the legislative branch and the governor's office and the state agencies? When do you sit down and talk and communicate? When do you all develop that dialogue and what that kind of vision is going to be? I saw your editorial about the use of the state forest resources. I've talked with almost every one of you in your districts. And I'm sitting up here looking at only one representative from Portland proper and three from the Portland metropolitan area. I've watched in the last 30 years the outlying parts of this state turn into service-based jobs with declining population. I watched some of the areas that are the driving dynamic parts of this forest, the Willamette Valley down the I-5 up the Columbia River. Those are the battlegrounds over our natural resources. And if all of you, Democrats and Republicans and statewide candidates, and don't make your interest groups sit down and give you straight, solid talk and thinking on this and find a compromise and a balance that moves forward to a common goal, we are going to be screwing around here for the next 15 years, and we will be the next Mississippi.
Any other questions of Tom? Thank you, Tom. Thank you for decimal. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2535 and open the work session on House Bill 2535. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, can I move the dash one?
Yes, we have to move the dash one. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2535.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2535. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2535 as amended to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2535 as amended to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carried. It's on its way to budget. Okay, let's see. Now I'm going to I'm going to open a public hearing on, let's see, have we done a public hearing before?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1006. Janet, could you give us a summary, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1006 was heard, I think it was just on this week on Monday, requires public contracting agencies to document their determination of the lowest responsible bidder on a form prescribed by the Bureau of Labor and Industries and submit the form to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. You have today, and we just received them this morning, the Dash 1 amendments. And, Mr. Chair, I believe they changed the submission of the form to the Construction Contractors Board. That's on page 2 of the amendments. And I think that there are people here to go through the other changes in the amendments.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Dugan Patty, please. See here.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bob, did you want to?
Mr. Chair, those were strictly technical amendments, and I think Craig was instrumental as well as you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Dugan. I waited until you went outside.
Good morning. Sorry for my timing, Mr. Chairman. I think you have in front of you the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1006, and they really reflect the discussion that we had earlier in the week on this particular bill. They're basically technical amendments because, for the most part, the LC has found that removing, at least from prospective bidder, removing the term prospective from bidder, that prospective didn't make much difference in there. And then the rest of it is to put the form in for the responsibility determination, which is what's been done.
Okay.
And I would say that DAS supports this amendment and requests the committee pass it.
Okay. Is there any questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 1006? Okay, we're in work session. Representative Schaffler.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 1006.
Representative Schaffler moves the Dash 1 amendments into 1006. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1006 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffer moves Senate Bill 1006 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilman.
Chair, I'll give you a courtesy vote on this, but I've got to talk to some senators. There's 13 of them that didn't like this. So.
I had a conversation with some of those senators, and my perspective in the conversation with them, it was not to do with the substance of the bill. It was the direction of where the permit or the information would be going to. It was in the original bill, it was to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and that has been removed, and now it will be going to the DCBS.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But you certainly have the same conversation if you can. Yeah. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I share the same concerns as the good representative, and whether it's BOLI or DCBS, I think it's unnecessary, and I will also say that I think the existing language, as I stated before, for lack of better word, in a state that prides itself on its progressive nature, I think it opens itself up a huge can of worms there, and I would like to see the existing language change, so I will be voting no.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative Escobar.
Share some concerns about this particular bill, and I will give a courtesy vote to get it to the floor, but I still have to do some more research on it.
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I don't I don't want to beat a dead horse. I already have that reputation. But you know, if the committee has those concerns, I would just make mention to the committee that once those concerns, once this goes to the floor, you have left with just that, and that's concerns. So.
My comments would be that I do have some concerns, but not necessarily about this bill, but about some practices that's going on within the contracting within the state of Oregon. I think no better example of that is what took place with the contract down in Coos County over a pipeline down there, and a couple other contracts that have happened with the state of Oregon that I think maybe this won't remedy all that, but it'll go a long ways towards remedying that, and that type of activity is not only cost the state of Oregon and local governments a great deal of money, but if there's a solution or a way to rectify those kind of things, I feel it's important that we move that direction, and so I'm supporting this bill. Representative Holman.
Mr. Chair, since everybody else is weighing in, I got to, too, I guess. I agree with the chair on this. I recognize the can of worms, but I believe this actually goes a direction that helps keep those worms in the can. So I'm going to support this bill wholeheartedly.
I think you ought to take them out and put them on the floor.
Save that for the floor, will you, Representative?
Let's vote quick.
Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
No.
Representative
Shaw. Aye.
Representative Steele.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman. Aye. Motion carries. Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gitts.
I would just extend to the minority party that all four Republicans on this committee had concerns with this bill before we passed it out. So there you go. You win.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I always have concerns on every bill that passes. Very concerned about every piece of legislation in this building.
Thank you, Representative. With that, we'll move on. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 4778.
Do we need a carrier on the floor?
Oh, yeah, it would help to have a carrier. Any volunteers? Representative Holman will carry on the floor. Thank you.
I might have a few questions just as an advance regarding your worm.
Again, open the work session on Senate Bill 4778. Janet?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to remember. I think that this bill we had on the schedule last time and we did not get to it. So this will be the first hearing on Senate Bill 477, but it has become the vehicle, as most of you know, for a number of items related to the prevailing wage laws. I just wanted to point out you have the -A5 amendments that we tried to get to you yesterday. Does everybody have them today?
I don't have them.
I don't have them.
-5s.
-A5s.
A5.
Yeah, she gave them to us yesterday.
She brought some down. No, well, that wasn't.
I brought the next version.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here, you can have mine. I'd rather find one, Janet.
Here's one.
Should we have committee?
Yeah. Good for us.
I'm really sorry I missed it.
Get out in the crowd and solicit them.
Pretty bad, the crowd asking. We know.
They just printed them.
They're just scared. Homie's going to start talking about worms again.
One thing I wanted to point out is that it's not a gut and stuff, and the portion of the original bill, Senate Bill 477A, that remains is Section 2, and the bold part is on the back of page 2, on the back of the bill on page 2, that if a contractor that files the certified statements that they have that are required under current law, that they've made payment, that the contractor has given a certified statement about the hourly wage they've paid and that they've complied with the prevailing wage law, if they public agency is required under this bill to retain 25% of the amount payable to the contractor if those statements have not been been made. Those certified statements have not been made. And there's those sections do remain in the bill as amended. There are some clarifications I think that someone's going to explain if that money will not be withheld if other certain things are taken care of. And then, Mr. Chair, the amendments begin Section 2. There's a new public works bond created in Section 2 of the bill of $30,000 that is able to be claimed against. And that's a new bond. There's Section, that's 2 through 5 of the bill. Section 7 of the bill is where the Representative Colby's bill about the contractor payment of the hire of the federal or the state prevailing wages. So that's in Section 7 of the bill. Section 8 of the bill is where there's the threshold change from $25,000 to $50,000, and that's on the bottom of page 7. This section also has that the funds of the public agency for a public contract does not include building and development permit fees that are waived or permit fees that are either paid or waived by a public agency, and that's on line 17 and 18 on page 7. And it also does not include staff resources of the public agency that either used to manage the project or to supervise, coordinate, or design or inspect the project. So those would not be considered as part of the cost of the public agency, the funds of the public agency. Lines 14, 15, and 16 are existing law that if it's a grant to a nonprofit, those are not also considered part of a public contract. And then at the top of page 8, it says that the project value must include the value of donated materials, or excuse me, may not include the value of donated materials or work performed by volunteers, but it must include in sub B the value of the work that's performed by any person that's paid by a contractor or a subcontractor on the project. And Mr. Chair, I think that's the meat of the bill. You don't hardly have to pay attention to Section 13. It's about four pages, and it just takes out the turn flagger. So.
Okay, thank you, John. Jessica, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Harris-Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors to urge your support for the Dash 5 amendment. Janet has done an outstanding job in walking through what these amendments do. I'm here to answer any questions you have, but first we'll explain in more detail the bonding component so that it takes up a significant portion of the amendments, and it is a new concept, so we want to put on the record what this is intended to do. Today, on public works contracts, general contractors on those projects are required to post a performance and payment bond unless the agency chooses to exempt that. But in the event that the general puts that performance and payment bond up there, subs are often not required and are not required by statute, but general contractors rarely require their subcontractors to obtain payment bonds. What this means is when there is a wage claim filed, if it is an employee of a subcontractor, the general contractor's payment bond is then withheld until that claim is resolved. Regardless, so the responsible party is not the one bearing the cost for failure to pay appropriate wages. It's the general's bond that's in play. What our goal here in working with BOLI and the other stakeholders is to establish a bond. It's a one-time bond that you set with the CCB that will enable BOLI to attach to that bond first for wage claims in the event that a subcontractor didn't pay their workers properly or allegedly didn't pay their workers properly. That bond is attached to first. And then the remainder, if there is more than $30,000 worth of claim, the remainder attaches to the general bond, the general contractor's bond. The purpose is to try and create some equity in a fairness standpoint in managing the responsibilities and liabilities for paying and failure to pay wages appropriately. This is an important concept that AGC has been working on for quite some time, and we really appreciate the cooperation of the other stakeholders in making this happen, and appreciate Bully working with us and the CCB working with us to make this work on a technical level, and appreciate this committee's consideration thereof. Other than that, happy to answer any other questions about the amendment.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, would you explain 7A to me on page 2, line 20 to 26, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Esquivel, the purpose of this provision, which enables a minority women, disadvantaged or emerging small business, certified under the certification requirements established for all DBs and other emerging small businesses, to take a year exemption once they've certified, is to allow those small and emerging businesses the opportunity to get on their feet for a year and get themselves established and financially viable enough to obtain this bond. A new company may have some issues obtaining this bond. We want to give them a year to develop some financial capability and kind of a test run. And because often contracts will require use of these small businesses, we want to make it possible for them to, as our subcontractors to be viable, especially in that first year, to obtain these kinds of bonds and participate.
Who determines disadvantage?
Mr. Chair, that determination is made based upon a series of factors at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, ORS 200.055. That whole series in there sets out the requirements for falling into one of these categories. So it's a decision made not by made by that agency based upon a series of criteria.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, hit my concern right on the head with lines 20 through 26. I've been talked to by several folks on this bill, Jessica included, and every handout that I received never mentioned anything regarding this particular section. My concern comes with how does this play? I mean, I understand that the small business and the incurred costs that mm-hmm. are as a result of just doing business. I mean, that's... And that's the same if you start a McDonald's franchise. You've got an incurred cost as a result of starting up. When you go into that business, you know what it is. Does this, I mean, do you think this provides, it's two questions, an unfair advantage for anybody that falls within this particular category? And number two, is it not a, I mean, is that not a public risk by not requiring them to have, you know, this bonding? I mean, is it, maybe I'm not understanding.
Sure.
You know, why not just not have bonds then for everybody? If it's not in the public good to have bonds, so I guess. Or how much do these bonds cost? So three questions.
Okay, let me make sure I got all these in order. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, as to the first point about whether this creates an unfair disadvantage for folks in this situation within the first year that they become licensed or certified under this statute, we don't believe so. These are folks that are, quite frankly, one, two-man shops that are just trying to make a go of it. These are folks that were often, there is a percentage goal or aspirational this or that we're required to meet on these projects. And so from a general contractor standpoint, it is to our advantage to give these folks some time to kind of matriculate into the industry and have a run at it for 1 year. We don't believe that that causes a disadvantage to anybody else because these folks are, again, just starting out, and there are other quite frankly, broader advantages for those folks in the statute today, some set-aside programs, et cetera, that will enable them quite frankly, a broader advantage than this provision would create. So from that perspective, we don't believe that this is some windfall, but more of a kind of extension of a hand up to these folks as they're just starting business. So that's not a concern of ours. The second component, I believe, was about what the cost of these bonds might be.
That was the third. The second component was the consumer protection, I guess for lack of a better word, the consumer protection component that is jerked out for this particular group, essentially, and maybe I'm not understanding. I perceive that bond as being there as a backup and saying, hey,
sure.
If something goes haywire, we've got this, which is why you file that. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, we agree from the consumer protection standpoint, which is why we've been working on this concept for quite some time. But in terms of bringing this forward, we believe this to be a great first step. On as far as where the workers are protected, if there is a requirement that the emerging small business or anyone certified under these statutes must inform the public agency if they're the contractor, or inform the general if they're subcontracted, that they're on the project, they're exercising this one-year exemption, and then the general contractor's performance and payments bond is on the hook for any claims that would come under from that one subcontractor. That means that the general contractor will watch very, very closely any certified payrolls and the activity going on with that subcontractor. Secondarily, from the consumer protection standpoint, there is no protection today as it relates to that subcontractor. It's the general who stands in the event that there are wage claims. So we aren't changing that. We're just giving a chance for those folks to get on their feet for 1 year and then move forward. The final issue in terms of cost, bonds can range anywhere from 1% of the cost of the bond, anywhere up to 10%. It depends on your creditworthiness. It depends on your financial status. It is really a wide-ranging thing that it depends upon the individual situation. For most folks, this is going to be a nominal cost.
Jessica, this bond we're talking about here is to deal with potential labor claims and not with performance bond as far as the quality of work, right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Representative Schoenfer.
That's what I was going to say, Mr. Chair. My bond as a general contractor ensures the homeowner that if for whatever reason I'm not there to finish their driveway gets finished. This is in case somebody doesn't pay their workers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoffler, that is correct, and this is only for public works contracts. So this is not broad. This will not affect most residential unless they decide to get into the public marketplace.
And so the trucker that buys an extra dump truck and he drives one himself, he hires someone to drive the other. If he had to pay that $3,000 for a bond, he might not be able to pay the guy driving the other truck, right?
perhaps. But we believe, Mr. Chair, that there is this will become a cost of doing business that will be built in, but provides a level of protection and equal playing field. There is an incentive by requiring this bond for folks to have substantial creditworthiness and good performance in terms of payment of their workers, which is a concern today. Folks who don't necessarily have the best track record of doing so aren't held as their company responsible, so they can continue to play in that marketplace all the while the general contractor holding that liability. Eventually that may weed some folks out, but at the end of the day this will hold the responsible party responsible, and we believe that to be fair.
Representative Kitts.
One other quick question. Are there sideboards put in when it says emerging small businesses? I may be way off base, but I have this vision of somebody getting certified as an emerging small business, filing the exemption. The ability there, I realize the general then takes on the ability of that sub under their bonding. I get all that. But what's to stop these folks from for lack of a better word, just, you know, putting the screws to their employees, falling under the general contractor. They don't have a bond. Dissolving that business and starting another business under a different assumed business name, getting their certification. Are there, why couldn't somebody continue to do that on a, you know, just a rotating basis? Are there provisions in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, there isn't that necessarily that kind of prevention today. I mean, that's the kind of thing that can happen, and not that I'm all that familiar with it happening on a frequent basis, but can happen today. What will eventually occur if someone continues to behave in that manner is that that'll eventually get around, and they'll have an off-hall time getting work.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
I think it's pretty straightforward, but I want to make sure the $50,000 level, if we're doing a little project out here and we get some volunteers that come in and a couple businesses that donate items, and that amount comes up to $50,000, and then the work that's done is $50,000, what we pay. That's a $100,000 project, but it still would not be covered under this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, as long as those materials are donated, they do not count towards the cost, overall cost of the project. And that's on page 8, line 1. And if you look at, start at the bottom of page 7, projects for which the contract, the prevailing wage requirements don't apply to projects for which the contract price doesn't exceed $50,000. And then in determining the price of the public contract, a public contracting agency may not, which is a new term for shall not, include the value of donated materials. So those $50,000 worth of donated materials do not count towards the amount of the contract price.
Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, back to the to the bond issue here a little bit. The very last statement on, it's actually at the top of page 5, where the commissioner may not make a claim for the same unpaid wages against more than one bond under this section. I'm just clarifying that we're talking about the same wages, where if the wages aren't satisfied under one particular bond, then they can turn to the general contractor bond and try to recover those wages. I just wanted to make sure that we're not saying that the commissioner makes a claim against the subcontractor bond, doesn't recover it, but since he's made that one claim, he can't go after the general.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the intention of that provision, I think, is in line with what you're saying. What we're trying to avoid is in the event of a $5,000 claim, which goes against the subcontractor's bond, and then there's the general contractor's payment bond, there is another $5,000 tacked on there, and then against the general's own personal public works bond. So you have $15,000 worth of claims for a $5,000 claim. We just don't want to see that happen, and we understand Boley doesn't either. That was really important to the bonding industry to ensure that there wasn't this kind of stacking effect where which would make writing these bonds more difficult.
Right. I just wanted to make sure that if a $5,000 claim was made on, or $5,000 worth of wages, and it wasn't satisfied under one bond, you could go after the other to fulfill that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Holley, that is correct. Mr. Chair, I also want to clarify and talk just a little bit about the federal-state prevailing wage provisions. These provisions are designed primarily for ODOT projects, and I know that John Jackley with ODOT is here and may say a few words as well. But these kinds of projects, where these provisions are really going to kick in is primarily in Southern Oregon. Where there are federal Davis-Bacon rates that are, because they don't survey on a frequent basis, those rates kind of locked themselves in and are often significantly lower, or from time to time are significantly lower than the state prevailing wage rate. The reality for contractors, highway contractors in that region, is you can't get people out to the job site if you're paying the lower rate. You just, they won't go. They'll say, thank you very much. There's a project down the street, and I can make a decent wage. So I appreciate the job offer. Off I go. In order to keep qualified and the high level of folks that we want on those jobs, our folks, as a general rule, pay the higher rate today anyway. So as a matter of practice, the cost here is not going to be substantially more on a project basis. We're not talking about a huge shift as far as our highway folks are concerned. I asked them, you know, what's the impact to you? And they said, well, the reality is their major concern was having to try and figure out what the rates were. But short of that, they, as a general practice, pay the higher of the rates. So from an on-the-ground standpoint, this isn't a huge shift as far as the contractors are concerned. We are pleased that the legislation does indicate that BOLI will create essentially two books, the first book being the book they create today, that has the state rates in it, and then they will sit down and figure out the look at the federal rates and look at the state rates and create a combined book that says, here for these kinds of projects, here are the rates that you need to pay. So a public agency just needs to figure out what kind of project they've got and staple the right rates to the back of the specs. The contractors will have those in place so they know which rates to pay. We believe that this makes it most easy for agencies to make sure they've got it right, and contractors that they've got it right, so there isn't mass confusion and different rates out there, that it comes from one source and an agency that's used to making those kinds of decisions and publishing those kinds of rates.
Other questions? Representative Katz.
Jessica, on that 7A section, is there any preference given to the folks that fall under those regarding public contracting?
In terms of the ESBs?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, there is not in this language here in this set of amendments. In another section of statute, and I apologize, I don't have ORS 279C in front of me, but there is in statute a preference, an ability for an agency to give preference to folks that fall under those categories. Those preferences are not often used. However, they do exist to give the agency the ability to, quite frankly, do a set-aside program should they so choose. There are good reasons for doing some of those programs, again, because these folks are getting their feet wet in the public marketplace that, quite frankly, is not an easy marketplace in which to maneuver. There are incredible requirements, and it is not easy. So helping those folks become the kind of contractors that are solvent, financially stable, and able to compete in this market, that quite frankly become our subcontractors, is definitely in our interest, and we help them to do so outside of this process. But from a preference standpoint, there is not a direct preference, though there is the ability for an agency to do so. There is the ability for them to do such that if they so choose. I apologize for the lengthy answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one little last piece of this that I was looking at, and it's on page 11. It's, I guess, line 27, towards the end, where the public agency is not required to verify the truth of the contents of the certified statements, and then it goes on where the contractor isn't required to verify the subcontractor's statements. I'm just curious, is there anything in statute that has any repercussions for a subcontractor or a contractor for not providing truthful certified payroll statements?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I am they are required to submit those statements, and I believe that there is a civil penalty applied if those statements are not accurate at the BOLI level. Our concern here, and the reason why the certified statements by the contractor under this section are the language that follows on lines 28 and 29 on page 11, and I believe there's similar language that is copied under the next section there. The purpose of that is so that when you're turning them in, when you turn them in with your stuff, and it may be lengthy sets of documents, we want to ensure that payment moves forward pursuant to this section, that there isn't that withholding that occurs. However, it doesn't erase any other responsibility that the subcontractors or the general contractors have to ensure that those statements are accurate. But in terms of withholding of payment, there is not that requirement to make sure that they are absolutely correct before you make payment.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Jessica? Don't see any. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I have John Jackley, please? Hold on. I think it's good afternoon now. Just is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley with the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'll be very brief, I promise. I wanted to address the section dealing with prevailing wages. A couple of points. First of all, the Federal Highway Administration will reimburse us for the higher rate, whether it's state or federal. It does come out of our fixed pot of federal funds, but by having Federal Highway reimburse us regardless of which of the higher rate is paid, it greatly eliminates the hassle factor and whatever loss of efficiency we would have in trying to separate which funds was which on any particular project for the purposes of paying those wages. Secondly, our cost estimators are telling me the same thing that Jessica just said, that because of the upcoming construction boom, the general shortage of skilled labor, is that in practice we're paying mostly the higher wage anyway, just to get people to show up on the job. Thirdly, the provision in the amendments that has the Bureau of Labor and Industries putting together a single book greatly reduces any potential efficiency impact on us. If we had to do it ourselves, we'd have to do about 37,000 calculations a year. By having BOLI do it, it's streamlined, it's centralized, and we just won't have to do that. And then fourthly, we feel that by paying these kind of wages, we would continue to support family wage jobs in Oregon and help ensure a continued supply of skilled labor for our upcoming construction boom. Thank you.
Does ODOT have any contracts in the lower level between that under that $25,000 threshold or $50,000 threshold?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with respect to the not with respect to prevailing wages, but with respect to
the trigger that the threshold triggers prevailing wage now at $25,000 and will at $50,000. Do you ever have any contracts down that small, or most of them a lot larger than that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll double check, but most of ours should be larger than that.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, so that the proponents of the bill and they know who they are, I've requested that very information from both of them, and I have not forgotten. I have just not followed up, but I did request that information of everybody that was in my office regarding this bill.
Thank you. No other questions. Let's see. Could I have John O'Shell, please? Okay.
Chair Brown, Chair Brown, members of the committee, once again, can be relatively brief.
short analysis, we're neutral. But since we've made a...
For the record.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties. Since we've had a number of comments on some of the bills that got folded into this amendment, felt like we should comment to indicate that, yes, our concerns have been addressed as far as some of the details on it. The whole issue of the bonding, our issue was to make sure it was clear which was the agency's responsibility and which was the contractor's responsibility. I have to be careful there because typically the agency does not see the subcontracts. And so we need to make sure that we weren't the ones responsible for enforcing the subcontracts. We do have language in there that our contracts require the contractors to require the subcontractor to do it. So it is there, but it's not us doing the enforcement of subcontractors. On the threshold, once again, as said before, that is an issue that AOC is neutral. But to the question of what is the value, I did a quick check. As most of you are aware, as part of the budget process every year, every public agency turns in a report of what projects we are planning on doing, public improvement projects, whether we're going to do it by ourselves, whether we're going to do it by contract. Using that report for the 2005 fiscal year, projects between 25 and 50,000. The counties were planning on doing 18 of them for a value of $645,000. So pick your number as to whether you think it's a savings or a loss. If you said it's a 10% saving, you come up with $65,000. If you say we're more efficient with the better wages, then go the other direction. But basically $650,000 in contracts is what is talked about. The 25% retainage, we will have a little bit of administrative costs on that, but once again, our costs compared to the potential benefit to the contracting community, we're willing to go with that, and so we stand neutral on that. We do believe that the volunteer donation language does do quite a bit to clarify what is going on for what everyone thinks should be happening. The issue on the nonprofits, our suspicion is the definition is no better than what we have now, but I believe the decision is to defer that problem for further work, and I don't believe this language makes it any worse. We do appreciate the language that made it clear that the governmental functions of sort of managing projects, doing inspections and so forth like that, don't all of a sudden turn it into a public works project. That language was an administrative rule, but we appreciate that we're getting it clarified in the law. The issue on paying federal or state, once again, on the policy issue neutral, where we will see most of the impact is on our federal aid projects. Most of them, in fact, are managed by ODOT, and so they're the ones that have to deal with the bureaucratic part of it. Where we end up is we will pay if we have to pay extra, and of course that is somewhat questionable whether we will, but it would come out in just increased match money. It will come out in less money available for additional projects if, in fact, there's an increase. Once again, there's a question whether or not there's much of an increase. We will have a few projects that are not ODOT projects that, in fact, are federally funded, and we will have to comply with this law. But the way it has been set up, we believe we can do that administratively quite well without any major additional problems. So, in short summary, we're fine with the bill.
Thank you, John. Any representatives?
Just for clarification, you're neutral on the bill? Okay. Thank you.
Could we have Bob Avery, please?
Bob, if you're neutral, you can just say so.
I'm not neutral.
Oh, Chairman Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Bob Avery. I'm Chief of Staff for Representative Hanna. We represent House District 7, which is in Eastern and Lane and Douglas counties. Representative Hanna's goal when running for office was to build Oregon communities from the ground up and to do whatever we could to help our communities be a better place. I want to remind you of our earlier testimony that in meetings around our district, many of our small towns expressed concern in building their communities. They talked about the problems arising from the regulations on public contracting, especially small contracts, and especially when volunteer and nonprofit organizations were involved. I'm the folks ahead of me, and Janet did a wonderful job of recapping what we think is happening in these amendments. I do want to talk a little bit to the process. We want to thank Chairman Brown and the other members of here. We for working with us as we coordinated a work group to build consensus, and I believe we have a broad consensus among the various stakeholders. I also want to thank all those that participated in the work group, many of whom are sitting in back of us now, or in front of you folks. We had a broad group, many different interests. There were representatives of the various trades, representatives of contracting groups, the cities, the counties. Even a few of you were able to attend some of those work groups. And to that, I think we ended up with a good product. I think this is good legislation for moving the issues forward. We've heard details, and certainly Jessica and some of the others that have spoken already are far better equipped to talk about the details. I'm not going to go through most of the rest of my testimony other than to say we think it's a good compromise and achieves what we set out to do in helping, you know, bring the improve the small contract environment and improve the ability for volunteers and the public-private sector to achieve those small community improvement projects that was our goal. So, Mr. Chair, in kind of summing this all together, there was a lot of give and take on these issues. You know, this is certainly, just like any other legislation, it's a compromise. We are enthusiastic about what we've achieved in bringing what we believe has been achieved, if you folks agree with us, in bringing this agreement together. We never intended with this group to deal with that broader issue of what is a public works contract. There are other work groups, task forces working on that, so it was not the intention of this group to come up with those definitions. We believe that the results here, this agreement does present a unique opportunity to do just what we set out, to build Oregon from the community up. And we urge passage with a due pass recommendation. We would also ask, Representative Brown has asked to be added as a chief co-sponsor and had the agreement of the original sponsors of the bill. So he'd asked if he could participate in being a carrier, you know, co-carrier, whatever you call that, at the appropriate time. May I answer any questions?
Any questions, Mom? Representative Gibbs.
I just want to be clear, you support the bill.
Yes, we do.
Any other questions? Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 477? Seeing none, let's be in the public hearing.
I thought we were in a work session.
Were we?
No. No.
Public hearing.
We're in
the
hearing.
We're in a work session. Okay.
Thank you, Katie. Derek pays attention.
He keeps
Janet going. Doesn't.
Oh.
Good me.
I've waited 5 months to be right, okay?
I have a sharp pencil, Janet.
Katie could be wrong.
Okay. The chair would entertain a motion to adopt the A5s. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, since we're in work session, I will move to adopt the dash A5 amendments into Senate Bill 477.
Representative Kitts moves adoption of A5 amendments to Senate Bill 477. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So done. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 477 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 477 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Talked it out. Seeing none, Katie, we'll call the roll.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chalker.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Gelman.
Aye.
Representative
Foley. Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Consent calendar.
Think it's worth a try?
Secure it. Put it on.
I'd be glad to carry it, and I think Representative Hannah will be a co-chair carrier with me. Representative Shields.
Oh, is this appropriate to allow them to vote on the previous bills at this time?
To suspend the rules is the motion.
Representative Shields moves the rules be suspended to allow...
Only Representative Shoffler.
Representative Shoffler and Representative gets on the vote on
316A.
On Senate Bill 316.
I vote aye.
I vote aye, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Kitts votes aye. Representative Shoffler votes aye on Senate Bill 316.
Any objections to them being placed on the consent calendar?
And any objection for that bill being placed on the consent calendar?
No, I'm carrying
316. Anything else?
Oh, wait.
I'm carrying 316.
Never mind. He's carrying.
Do you mind if he carries 316?
I don't mind.
Well, I carry 316.
Should it be on the consent calendar?
I don't know.
And we are adjourned, huh?
No meeting till Wednesday morning.